Morning. Thank you for inviting me to give this talk. I'll be talking today about, well, first of all, let me acknowledge the team of people who contributed to this work. I have several new graduate students working on the Madison Dynamo experiment, Elliot Kaplan and Zane Taylor. And I also have a collaboration going with Klaus Reuter and Frank Yenko from the IPP in Garching, and they're running the simulations that I'll be showing, so they should be acknowledged. Okay, the outline for my talk is I'm going to take maybe the first 10 minutes and review what I think the big results from the Madison liquid sodium experiment are. And I'll give references, and if you want more details, we can discuss them. But I think it's important to look at where we are and what we've done on the Madison experiment before talking about the next topic, which is where we're going with the Madison experiment, that some changes that we're planning to implement to be able to observe a more self-sustained dynamo, and then I'll be talking about a possible future new direction, which uses a plasma rather than liquid sodium for studying dynamos. And this turns out to be quite exciting because it will allow us to move into more astrophysically relevant regimes, I think. Okay, so the Madison dynamo was designed to investigate the Dudley and James dynamo. And just to review for you what this thing looks like, I have a movie which we have two counter-rotating propellers inside a spherical vessel. And the eigenmode, which is expected to grow for this, as well as the VKS experiment, is a transverse dipolar dynamo. And this movie illustrates how this is essentially a stretch-twist-fold dynamo. If you take that seed field, which is a transverse dipole, and these propellers, which have thrust out along the poles, stretch the field lines and twist them, and takes them and then folds them back upon the original field, the system acts as a dynamo. This picture is a very laminar picture, and this is also a cartoon in the sense that this is the infinite conductivity limit. So this is just assuming that the magnetic field lines are frozen into the moving fluid. But it illustrates the key features of amplification of the field lines and the positive feedback due to the particular flow we use. The reason I show that is because the next picture shows a movie from a simulation of what the velocity actually looks like in a liquid metal when the fluid Reynolds number is much larger than the magnetic Reynolds number, which is a property of all liquid metals. The Prandtl number, the magnetic Prandtl number, is a small number, and so these systems are always quite turbulent, okay? So when we designed the experiment, it was based upon a laminar type picture of what the flows would be, and but in fact, the system has turbulence, and it has turbulence levels which are big. And the implication of those turbulence, so just before I go forward, this simulation, by the way, is a direct numerical simulation in which we have a spherical stationary outer sphere boundary condition. We don't have an inner core, and we introduce a body force into these regions that introduces rotation and an axial thrust. And this forcing term works very, very nicely for studying the types of flows that we have in the experiment. Okay. So the implications of this turbulence on the dynamo threshold are quite profound. This is the result of a series of simulations for this realistic numerical model we have, in which the fluid Reynolds number, which is along this axis that controls the turbulence levels and so forth, is plotted versus the magnetic Reynolds number for the simulations. And what you find is that that low fluid Reynolds number, when the flow is laminar, then the picture that I showed you in the first slide is essentially correct. And the dynamo threshold given by the magnetic Reynolds number is about, well, roughly 100, okay? And the experiment was designed to be around here. So as you increase the fluid Reynolds number, the system would self-excite at about this value. Now, as you increase the fluid Reynolds number and the turbulence begins to develop in this region, what we find is that the threshold for dynamo onset actually increases as the turbulence levels increase, and so actually, at least asymptotically, we get the impression from our simulations that the threshold for seeing the dynamo in these open, unconstrained flows is about 5 times larger. That is, we'd have to make the magnetic Reynolds number 5 times bigger than we initially thought to see self-excitation. So this is quite detrimental. And unless you use something like iron or something else to modify this and reduce it further, it'll be hard in our experiment to see this. Okay. So this is consistent with our observations of decay rates and other things. And so we've been thinking about where to go then with the Madison experiment, and I'll show you how we might address these things to actually see a self-excited dynamo in a bit. Okay, so now I'm going to show you, so that's the background for the Madison experiment. Here's a picture of the experiment. Here's the sphere in the center. We have an extensive set of diagnostics measuring the 3D character of the magnetic field. The sodium sits in here, it gets fills the sphere when we're running experiments, we have motors that drive the flows, and so forth. Okay. Okay, so now I'm going to go through basically 3 results and summarize them for you quickly. We have been carrying out what you might call test field experiments. We apply magnetic fields from coils on the outside, and then we study the response of the system, the response of the experiment to these externally applied fields, and we try to learn something about the role of turbulence from those measurements. The first result that I want to call your attention to is an experiment in which we observed, we applied a magnetic field along the axis of the experiment, which shared the symmetry axis of the mean flow. Okay, and so we detected a dipole field that was induced by the currents flowing in the sodium, and we proved theoretically that if the flow was axisymmetric and the magnetic field was axisymmetric, that this dipole moment couldn't exist. So this was so the implications of that proof and the observation that there is a dipole moment in the experiment immediately told us that mean field effects must be playing some role. Non-symmetric turbulent fluctuations in the velocity field and the magnetic field must be contributing to the currents that make up this dipole. And so I refer you to this for more details on that. Following on that, we were then able to carry out some experiments where we we're able to directly account by looking at Ohm's law quite carefully, making measurements of the mean velocity field and the mean magnetic field to infer what the magnetic field induced by the turbulent fluctuations had to be. And what we found is that the magnitude of the magnetic fields generated by this term are basically the same order as those due to the induction terms coming from the mean flow and the mean magnetic fields. And so, in some sense, this is the sort of thing that you'd like to look for if you're trying to understand, an alpha effect or a beta effect that's present in the experiment. So this is real direct observations of mean field effects in an experiment. And again, here's the reference for that. And then finally, we found that there is a when we were looking at the fluctuations measured on the surface of the sphere, when we increase the magnetic Reynolds number of the experiment, we find that there's a preferable tendency for the fluctuations to give a transverse dipole. So this is the experiment, this is the eigenmode we're expecting to see penciled in here. And what we found was that there were intermittent statistics in which we would see a dipole moment transiently excited at the equator, but that it wouldn't sustain itself. So we have not yet observed a fully sustained dynamo, but there does seem to be an approach to dynamo in which this eigenmode is observed quite frequently. And so we call this intermittent magnetic field excitation. Okay. So that's what we've done so far in the experiment. The next steps for us are to modify the experiment to include a series of baffles inside the experiment. These are relatively small baffles, maybe an inch and a half thick. One at the equator. This is similar to what the VKS experiment has done to reduce the sloshing between the hemispheres. And then we have a set of controllable pitch poloidal baffles, which can be used for adjusting the flow helicity of those two vortices. And by controlling then the net the relative pitch of the velocity field, we think we can optimize experimentally the flow for seeing the dynamo happen. The other implication of these baffles is that they greatly reduce the turbulence. And so we've done computational fluid dynamic studies of the actual propellers. We've made measurements of the propellers, input them into a CFD code, and then introduce baffles into the experiment, and then run the simulations to see what type of flows we would get. And what we find is without baffles, the turbulent energy predicted by the simulations is something like 0.7. If you add the equatorial baffle, the fluctuations are reduced by about half. And then by adding the poloidal vanes to redirect the flow and further optimize it, the fluctuations can be reduced by almost a factor of 7 in the simulations. Okay, the impact of the fluctuation reduction on something like a turbulent beta effect, an anomalous resistivity associated with the fluctuations, is huge. And so we think that reduction of the fluctuations would allow us to basically use the experiment and understand the experiment from a laminar point of view. Okay, the other thing is, and then by carrying out kinematic calculations, it looks like that this adding the poloidal vanes will allow us to reach self-excitation in the experiment. Okay, that was the first thing that we're doing. The second thing that we're doing that we hope will allow us to see self-excitation is based upon recent observations by our group and also simulations by Yannick Ponty, in which a subcritical bifurcation was observed in simulations. And it's a little bit hard to make this out, but in this set of numerical studies, we found that what happened was we set up the simulations with a certain magnetic Reynolds number. We observed growth. And then at this point, we changed the magnetic Reynolds number to a smaller value and then watched the subsequent decay. And so what was found in these simulations is that you could actually, that the transition would be governed by a magnetic Reynolds number, which was relatively high. Once you are onto this branch, you could reduce the magnetic Reynolds number to a value which was considerably lower before transitioning back to a non-dynamo state, okay? And this is very encouraging because it would allow you, in principle, to do the same thing by applying a transverse magnet, a strong magnetic field to the sodium, and kick it into the dynamo state. And the implications are that we should be able to, by applying a strong transverse magnetic field, access the dynamo from a subcritical transition. And the parameters from the simulations indicate that it'll take just a modest increase in our magnetic field strength to be able to induce this. The idea is when you have a strong magnetic field, the fluctuations are reduced, and that reduces the effect of the turbulence on the flow and on the if you want to think about it as an anomalous resistivity, the fluctuations are reduced, and so now it becomes possible for the system to be self-exciting at a lower magnetic Reynolds number. And then once the dynamo is excited, that the dynamo itself is able to maintain the reduction in the turbulence. And so this is very encouraging. So applying a transverse magnetic field to the system, reducing the fluctuations, appears to be a path forward for observing a dynamo. Okay. So now that's the end of the liquid metal part of the talk. Now I'm going to change gears a little bit, and And so this is just a little bit of motivation. There are a lot of big questions in astrophysics that have this common theme of magnetic field generation from plasma flow. And so we've heard talks about solar dynamos, we've heard talks about accretion disks and MRI, we've heard talks about galactic magnetic fields and galaxy clusters, and all of these systems are systems characterized by very large magnetic Reynolds numbers, much, much bigger than the magnetic Reynolds number that the liquid sodium experiments can get into. And they're also characterized by Prandtl numbers, which can vary all over the map, from small values like the liquid sodium experiments up to very big values. And the Prandtl number, as we know, has a big impact on what sort of dynamos one can get. Okay? So each of these observations can be related to a series of fairly poorly understood processes. There's the large-scale dynamo problem, the small-scale dynamo problem, the general idea of what does MHD turbulence look like when a system is magnetized or unmagnetized, the MRI, and then a whole host of additions to these problems that come when you think about plasmas rather than simple MHD systems. And so we've heard about the Hall effect, we've heard about anisotropic viscosities and other things impacting each of these things. And so it would be very interesting to not only study these phenomena, which can't yet be studied in experiment, but also to understand what real plasmas would look like. Okay. As I was looking at these, it's useful to look at what the critical parameters are for studying this. And this is not a number which is in common use, but it seems like the Cowling number, the ratio of the magnetic energy to the flow energy, is an important one. And all of these systems start out with Cowling numbers that are quite small. You want a system which has a large, a relatively small magnetic field compared to the flow energy. The magnetic Reynolds number, we all know about. The fluid Reynolds number, we know about. What we would like to be able to do is change the ratio of these two things. The Prandtl number is key. And so those processes map onto certain values that you have to be able to access if you wanted to study these things experimentally. And the point I want to make with this is, first of all, we need systems in which this Cowling number is quite small. Okay. That implies very, very low magnetic field, fast-flowing plasmas. And we want systems in which the magnetic Reynolds number is big. And by big, I mean something bigger than about 500 to 1,000. Okay? Not in order to get at these processes doesn't require that you be asymptotic, that you be in the at the same parameters that the astrophysical plasmas have. Rather, you just have to be above some critical value to start seeing the effect. Okay? And the critic, and about, roughly speaking, in order to get there, many of these things, like the small-scale dynamo, requires a magnetic Reynolds number bigger than something like 500 or so. Okay. A point about this Cowling number is, you might say, well, can't we make these plasmas in fusion plasmas? And the problem with fusion plasmas is that in order to make the systems hot enough to have a high magnetic Reynolds number, you need some thermal confinement. And the thermal confinement comes from externally applied magnetic fields that provide the thermal confinement. And so fusion plasmas have not studied this regime. They have magnetic fields which are playing a dominant role in the dynamics. Okay. So why not do it with liquid metal experiments? Liquid metal experiments have this advantage that the confinement is free. You just build a vessel and you put the sodium in it. But they have this very unfortunate power scaling in which the mechanical power required to reach a certain magnetic Reynolds number goes like magnetic Reynolds number cubed. Okay, so we have an experiment that reaches a magnetic Reynolds number of around 100. And in order to go to a magnetic Reynolds number of 1,000 would require increasing the power from something like 100 kilowatts to 100 megawatts, and or to 10 megawatts. And that's something that's just not going to be done. Okay, the other thing about liquid metal experiments is the Prandtl number is fixed. The magnetic Reynolds number is always much, much less than the fluid Reynolds number, and so the systems can't look at more laminar flows. Okay, so plasmas have the potential to vary the Prandtl number and to access much larger fluid Reynolds numbers, as I'll show. And they also intrinsically include these plasma effects that might be important in astrophysics: compressibility, collisionality, and so forth. Also, the diagnostic sets in plasmas might be significantly better than in liquid metals. Okay, so what do we need to study dynamos using a plasma? Well, we need to begin with a very small magnetic field. We want to stir the plasma to some value, and then we hope to see a magnetic field spontaneously created. So the challenge for plasmas is to create a large, highly conducting, okay, this means high temperature, unmagnetized, fast-flowing plasma. Two things. One is that we need some confinement in order to get the electron temperature up and to make the plasma conducting. And two, we need some technique for stirring the plasma. And so we think we've invented such a scheme. And so this is a concept I'm showing you of a plasma dynamo facility, which could study all of those processes I illustrated earlier. And the idea is take a vacuum vessel, and on the surface of the vacuum vessel, we're going to apply with permanent magnets a very, very high multipole magnetic field. And so think about each of these things as being an axisymmetric ring of magnets that alternates between pointing inward and outward. Okay, so this is, and then you get a magnetic field which does this sort of thing, this sort of picket fence geometry on the surface. Okay, and there's an axis of symmetry again which runs vertically here. So the thing about these magnets is that they provide a very, very high, it's kind of a cheat in that one has a magnetic field that's strong over a very thin region at the edge of the plasma. Okay. And so in some sense, we can think about this as being the vessel wall in a liquid experiment. You have to provide the confinement somehow, and so we're just going to localize that effect right here. Okay. In these types of devices, there are techniques for producing very high, high density, highly conducting plasmas, and that's less important than, say, the magnetic geometry at this point. Okay, if you look at the magnetic field then for this high order multipole, it drops off very rapidly. It's about a Tesla at the surface, and within 30 centimeters it drops to less than a Gauss. And so in a volume here which has a radius of larger than a meter, this would be a plasma that's essentially unmagnetized. Okay, so how are we going to make it flow? So the idea we have had is to take this, so this is just blowing up a little region near the edge, and in between each of these permanent magnets, we're going to have an electrode which runs around the experiment all the way, and we're going to be able to apply a bias, an electrical bias to this that can drive current across the faces of the magnets, and introduce an E cross B flow to the plasma in this region. So you'll see that because the direction of the magnetic field changes, if we apply an alternating bias to the electric field, the direction of the flow can actually be the same for all of these magnets. Okay, so just one power supply adjusted to all of these, just giving an alternating bias would give us a uniform flow. This scheme then introduces a flow in the thin boundary layer, and we assume that it will viscously couple to the unmagnetized plasma in the center of the device. Okay, and a really nice thing about this scheme then is that we can, by adjusting the bias as a function of latitude, we can introduce a rotation which actually varies with latitude. So the poles could be rotating in opposite directions, and we could do a von Karman-like drive. We could make the system rotate uniformly by imposing a rigid rotation boundary condition, or a whole slew of different possibilities, including time-dependent flows. And so this introduces a lot of flexibility. So to illustrate that, I'm going to show some results from simulations. We've done some tests of whether or not we could use a cusp field to drive those flows. And this is a case where we have a magnetic field that the flux lines don't come through here, but basically this is a an order 11 a dipole multipole field. This is the strength of the magnetic field, and we imposed an electric field boundary condition on the surface, which drove rigid rotation. So this is the toroidal velocity field that results from by specifying the boundary conditions of the electric field to drive it from the edge. And it appears that one can, in fact, drive flows by applying electric field boundary conditions and using this cusp field that I talked about. So the viscous spin-up time for the unmagnetized, the electric field very, very quickly equilibrates and gives E cross B flows in the edge that that can respond almost instantaneously. The longer time scale in these experiments is the viscous coupling in the center. And the viscous, that depends upon the Prandtl number that we happen to have chose. But these can be very viscous systems or very inviscid systems. So it varies a lot. Okay. So this is a formulary of the critical parameters. Don't worry too much here, other than to just look at the scalings that I have. So this is the magnetic Reynolds number for a plasma is equal to, well, the system size times the flow velocity you managed to get, and this is in kilometers per second, times the electron temperature to the 3/2 power. So if we can make this plasma very highly conducting, if it's well confined and we can heat it, we should be able to adjust the conductivity and go to quite large values. The fluid Reynolds number, on the other hand, depends upon the ion temperature, which tends to be quite cold, maybe a factor of 10 lower than the electron temperature in such machines. But the ion viscosity, which is what governs the viscosity, is determined by the mass of the ion, okay, and the density of the plasma that you have. And so this product of the ion mass squared times the density is a number which can be varied tremendously, okay? So this is just to illustrate the point that the ion viscosity can be changed by going from light ions to heavy ions. Going from helium to argon, say, is a big change in this number. And the density can go from low values to high values and change the collisionality. And so the fluid Reynolds number is a big adjustable parameter. Okay. And so for the experiment I just showed you, we think we can achieve magnetic Reynolds numbers which are sort of greater than 1,000, and fluid Reynolds numbers at this point, which vary from very low to very big. Okay, so we should be able to adjust the system to go from laminar to turbulent and so forth. The Larmor radius to the mean? Yes, so it depends upon the strength of the magnetic field that you might apply through some external source. And it turns out that the electrons are very very magnetized, that they don't exhibit collisions on a gyro radius on a cyclotron period. But the ions tend to be unmagnetized. They tend to be more collisional. But this could be adjusted. Okay, so I'm afraid I may have lost a slide. Let me see. Okay, let me start with this. So we've been doing some simulations of this. So I showed you one simulation which tried to study what the effect of this high order multipole cusp at the edge was, and I showed you that we could impose boundary conditions that drove the flow from the edge. We've also carried out a set of studies in which we took a sphere and we made the assumption that we could program the rotation as a function of latitude in a completely arbitrary fashion. Okay, so this would be a fluid experimentalist's dream, to be able to have a boundary condition which was continuously variable. Okay, and so we've done experiments. This is a von Karman-like drive in which we rotate the upper hemisphere in one direction. So we have a boundary condition on the toroidal velocity up here, which is spinning one direction, and then at the bottom it's spinning in the other direction, and the equator is basically stationary. Okay, you might, if you were thinking about the sun, you might realize that the sun, you know, has different rotation as a function of latitude. So this is the sort of thing that that we're imposing as a boundary condition here. And if you put in plasma parameters of 10 eV and 10 kilometers per second for the flow, and you use hydrogen, you get these fluid parameters. Okay, so this is a magnetic Reynolds number of 300, and this is a fluid Reynolds number of 100. The system is laminar, and what we find in the simulation is that the magnetic field grows up and saturates, and it's laminar, and it's exactly the picture that I showed you at the beginning. We're able to study a laminar dynamo in this case. Okay. Now we took the same type of simulation, and then we changed the plasma parameters slightly. We increased the electron temperature by only 3 electron volts. We used deuterium, so it's slightly heavier ion, or therefore a little bit less viscous. And we increased the flow velocity a little bit. So this now has a magnetic Reynolds number of 1,000 and a fluid Reynolds number of 400. It's a turbulent flow because it's at this Reynolds number, but the magnetic Reynolds number is larger than the fluid Reynolds number, unlike the liquid metal experiments. And lo and behold, in this simulation, what we find is that we get a small-scale dynamo. Okay, the magnetic field grows spontaneously at small scales, and there's no large-scale structure. And this would be very exciting. This could represent something like the galactic magnetic field. Okay, there are also. This is another simulation of the. This is the velocity field for a similar set of runs, and this is the magnetic field showing the small-scale dynamo. Okay. There are also more complicated flows that you could introduce. So, for example, you could rotate one direction here, the opposite direction here, change the direction again, and have a higher-order drive for the flow. And you could even make it time-dependent. It turns out by using this flow that the critical magnetic Reynolds number comes down a little bit. And so the point is only to illustrate that with these very flexible boundary conditions, we should be able to look at a whole new class of different drives that we're not able to do with a simple propeller structure. By having power supplies to adjust these things, time-dependent power supplies, things are much more flexible as a laboratory experiment. Okay. The final thought, there we go. I actually have two more thoughts. So another possibility for this experiment, and this hasn't been demonstrated by simulation yet, but if you imagine taking this sphere and you impose a boundary condition which makes it rotate rigidly, you know that the plasma is going to essentially be in a centrifuge. What will happen is the plasma will, there will be a force that forces the plasma to the outside, and because plasmas are compressible, one ends up with the density varying from the center to the inside. And so what one has is you have a stratification in the plasma, and it makes it possible to study a whole bunch of things related to convection. We can do compositional buoyancy by introducing light ions into a heavy ion flow. We might also be able to use the magnetic field in the thin boundary layer to mock up certain aspects of the tachocline. It's an inside-out sun. The tachocline is now at the outside. The effective gravity is due to rotation, which is out, and the density is hollow in the center and large at the edge. But nonetheless, the magnetic field-driven instabilities would occur in this region where the density is stratified. So we're quite excited about this, but we haven't we don't have simulations which demonstrate this yet. Okay. Here's another boundary condition which is of some interest. Here what we did was we programmed the rotation profile such that the vertical columns would represent Keplerian flow. Okay, and you can't do that at the pole. There's a singularity there. But we were able to get a velocity field, a rotation which dropped like the square root of r over some significant region here. And this is the type of profile you would want for studying the MRI. we took this velocity field and we applied a sequence of different magnetic fields to it, and it turned out above a certain critical value for an applied magnetic field, we observed a transition which looks a lot like the MRI in these simulations. So these type of boundary conditions might allow you to also investigate the MRI. Okay, so before building such a big experiment, it's useful to build a prototype and demonstrate that this electro drive scheme works, that you can make the plasma flow. And so that's what we're doing now. We've nearly completed the construction of a plasma couette flow. Okay, and so this is an experiment which has the same cusp confinement around the edge, but it's only a meter across, and it will use the same drive scheme for producing an unmagnetized plasma over some region. We're making it toroidal by having a set of magnets on the center post also, so that we can control the rotation here and here and impose a couette flow-like rotation over a central region. And our predictions are that for these type of plasma parameters, we only have to apply a very modest magnetic field in order to see this system become a dynamo, or to become an MRI, and that the MRI actually turns off if the magnetic field becomes too large, as predicted. This is a regime that's very hard to get to with liquid metal experiments, because it's hard to get to it's hard to build a magnet which is large enough to get to the point where it turns off. Okay, so this is a picture of the experiment, and this is the plasma source. It's a lanthanum hexaboride cathode. These are the magnets which we've just finished constructing. We'll be sticking them in, and hopefully next time I talk to you, I'll be showing you results. Okay, this is the summary. Thank you.
Well, obviously, near the outer boundary, you get a very strong magnetic field with a small-scale modulation. And I would imagine that also on top of your large-scale flow that you drive with these electrodes, you also have a modulation, small-scale modulation of the velocity. And I suppose what you want to do is to have them completely out of phase to avoid kind of mean field effects, which would interfere, obviously, with the actual dynamo process in the interior that you want to study. And have you thought about this?
I've thought a great deal about this. It's a hard problem, but what I can say, so from plasma physics, we know that if one has an electrode and you stick it into the plasma, what will happen is the potential will equilibrate along the field very quickly. The parallel conductivity will short out parallel electric fields, and the electric potential will become a poloidal magnetic flux function. Okay, and this in turn tells you that the structure of the electric potential in between these cathodes is only going to be is going to be strongly related to the magnetic field. Now, if you look at it more carefully, what you find is that every poloidal flux function actually rigidly rotates under those conditions. If the potential is a flux function, any single field line will rigidly rotate. So the condition is, this ends up, I think, dealing with the problem that you're raising, is that the magnetic field and the electric and the velocity field are going to be very strongly correlated in this region, and that the problem shouldn't be there. In fact, that's why I had the very, very uniform rotation in the simulations that I showed you, was because we could impose that boundary condition. It's without doing the experiment and actually looking at it, it's going to be hard to conclusively say something about this, though. But that's why we're doing the prototype experiment.
These are really nice perspectives, of course, with this very different kind of dynamo. I have two questions related to power problems. I've noticed that you had this 200 kilowatt cathode for making the plasma. That only works at the beginning, right, when you create the plasma, or you have that always on?
So I can tell you about the details of the source, and that's a good question. Actually, what you do is you have it becomes a triode tube rather than a diode tube. One has a grid around a strongly electron-emitting cathode, and the electrical circuit is localized to a small region in the center. The plasma streams out, and the currents from the cathode are quite localized. The power, you need to add power in order to sustain the plasma. So this would be on all the time.
Okay, so this probably will, have some convection or things, motions setting in, which is quite a very large power, no?
Except the thermal convection for unmagnetized plasma is huge. It should be isothermal, and the convection, I think the diffusion should be very, very rapid from that point of view. But once it starts to rotate and one has density stratification, then there may be something related to this.
Okay, and second question was a bit related to that. You've mentioned that there was these limitations in the power needed to drive a dynamo in this RM cube for liquid metal experiments. One limitation, of course, on top of that is that if you create a large magnetic field, you need the currents to sustain it, and these currents dissipate, and you have some power there. So is it something that you have estimated in the case of these plasma experiments, how much dissipation there would be, which then you would need to put into the electrical circuits driving the fluid?
There are several powers here. One is the power to ionize heat and maintain the temperature of the plasma. That's the big power. The power that's actually required to drive the flow is very, very small. It depends on the actual density of the plasma, but it could be up to the same level of power that it takes to sustain the plasma, but for lower densities, where the flow energy is significantly less, it's more on the order of tens of kilowatts. So it depends on the plasma parameters, and we could look at any, and it'll be interesting to see what regime we're actually operating in. But these are power supplies that are relatively easy. They're just DC power supplies, capacitor banks or something more sophisticated. But this isn't so hard to do.
More questions?
I have one question for a comment and one question. So I start with a question. First, in the simulation of a von Karman spherical quate, you mentioned, you say that with fairly low Reynolds number and high RM, you find a small scale dynamo. How do you get to this state? Did you study, by increasing slowly magnetic Reynolds number, you switch from no dynamo to these things, or what do you have in between? And did you try to push further the magnetic Reynolds number to see what's going on afterwards?
Yeah. So the simulations of the plasma dynamo
with
the Couette flow, right?
Yes.
Those simulations are long and expensive, and they're at fairly high magnetic Reynolds number. Eric Spence and Klaus Reuter are doing these simulations, and it turns out that they have pushed beyond what I've shown you here. I think up to magnetic Reynolds numbers of maybe 2,000 or so, and so it appears to be robust. We just turn it on, and the small scale dynamo starts out. That's I can't say much more than that. What happens. Yeah.
And my other question was to get your comment. It seems that with your code, which include boundary condition, you find about everything we found in Taylor-Green flow. It's really the same kind of
exactly the same
way. You have laminar versus turbulent, and also the hysteresis. And so it's really, why would you comment that it's so? I was sort of puzzled because it's not really the same flow. It's not the same boundary condition. So what
Very
do you think about
boundary,
it?
There's a big difference between an infinite
yes.
periodic box
yes.
and a bounded spherical flow. And so the boundary conditions are appropriate to experiment. And we use externally applied magnetic fields, and the system exhibits a subcritical transition. The simulations are very, very similar. Moreover, it really does reduce the magnetic Reynolds number you need in the experiment to the laminar value. It's very nearly the case that the critical magnetic Reynolds number that you have to be driving the system at is the value that it would be if it were laminar. And so if we can apply a large enough transverse magnetic field, we should be able to see this transition.
But then does this mean that we really have to run this very expensive simulation, and we couldn't just, you know, use because, you know, Taylor-Green simulation are much cheaper than the one you run, so does it mean we can spare the huge effort and stick to Taylor-Green, or what would you think? No, you're not.
Okay. More questions?
In the proposed experiment with the magnets around the chamber, it seems like if you didn't want to use the bias electric field, you could use the magnets as a rotating magnetic field. Have you thought of that?
We initially thought, why not just use an electrical motor to drive the flows at the edge. And electromagnets could be used. There's a variant on this that would do that. The permanent magnets have the advantage that they're relatively cheap to implement, and they don't require power to sustain them. Another important constraint for us here is that you need the confinement. You need the magnets to be nearly everywhere. But you still need to have access for diagnostics. You need to be able to put probes through, and so. We think that the permanent magnets are a nice compromise. The electromagnets would be quite thick, and they'd have to be everywhere, and diagnostic access would become more limited, I think. So this is just a DC induction motor, and so in some sense it's already a motor, but one could also use traveling waves to induce the flow.
Okay, and so perhaps last question from the right wing.
From the right wing. Can you tell us how many of these rings do you have in order to cover the sphere? You showed us one ring. What is the packing, and how much of a ripple is there between these rings?
So the constraints on the experiment are, A, that you need them to be far enough apart, just like I said, to get diagnostics through, and close enough together that the plasma can't get through. And so you can vary that almost continuously. They could be quite far apart. But the other thing that happens is when you go to a small number of rings, the magnetic field in the center gets bigger and bigger, and it becomes a magnetized rather than an unmagnetized plasma. So we think that we need to have a magnetic field over the bulk of the plasma, which is, you know, significantly less than the Earth's magnetic field, in order to really call this an unmagnetized experiment. Even if it were just sub-Gauss, the flow energy would be larger than the magnetic energy by a significant fraction, but it's still, we think we need to be able to make it almost unmagnetized for it to function.
So with that, let's thank Carrie again. So while our next speaker gets set up, just a brief